This is the Unshadowed Thought with James Hall. Welcome back. In this episode, we're going to address healing in the context of medical device injury, medication injury. I mean, really, it's just a methodology for healing generally. But in the survivor community, there is a lot more context for this. There's a lot more detail around this, and there's a lot more importance on it. So lots of people have come to me and asked, how are you healing? How do I heal? Can I heal? And so I wanted to lay down a cast that addressed those things directly, where people could come and just utilize this as a resource and hopefully learn some important things about the process. So with that said, let's get started. In the past, my casts have been more linear. They just have a story that kind of unfolds and all these things kind of get told about in order. In this one, I'll talk a little bit up front about what I plan on covering, the different dimensions of healing that I see, the things that have ended up being really important for me to understand and analyze and give kind of retrospective thought on, so that I can understand where I was, how I did, and then where I want to end up. So with that, in my mind, healing really falls into exercise, physical activity, how you're eating, what your environment is like in terms of stress and emotional factors. There's these other dimensions that affect healing, especially for people with neurological injuries like neuroplasticity. There's a community factor, so this issue of tribe is in there. And then there's some independent factors that kind of come in. There's kind of philosophical perspectives that off and spiritual perspectives that can play a really big role in healing and often do, usually do. So I'll discuss some of those things as well, especially things that have had a big impact on me. That being said, there's some really important ground rules that I want to cover. And with this cast, this is not medical advice. This is me sharing what I've learned about healing and what's worked for me and what I've learned from others. Any decision that you make is your own. I expect that people would learn and extrapolate from this cast, but ultimately your decisions are your own, and this is not medical advice. I will talk about some things that I think are healthy. A lot of that includes getting away and not relying on the medical model and medical treatments for healing, and I'll explain why I feel that way, but this is not pill shaming in any way, shape, or form. It's not device shaming. Like, if people want to get treatments and seek medical treatments and medication as a part of the healing process, or they're still on medication and trying to get off that, that's perfectly and absolutely fine. Every person defines their own boundaries for healing and what they can and can't do. Furthermore, quickly withdrawing from medication or cold turkeying medication is incredibly dangerous. And if you're not aware of the dangers of quickly making quick changes to your medication, or really definite changes to your medication, like making big changes or just not thinking the stuff through, it's a really bad idea. Making big changes to your medication can have severe impacts, and those are things you should study and try to discover. You should talk to your doctor about it if they're the ones providing the medication, but there's also an incredible amount of information in the community as well that needs, I think, has to be considered. There are a lot of things that doctors don't know about medication withdrawal or medication changes, which is ironic because that's their specialty. They're supposed to know explicitly about that. There is benzo warrior community for withdrawal and information about benzodiazepines. There is the Inner Compass initiative for withdrawal on other psychiatric medications, and there's other resources out there as well. But those two were a huge help to me in understanding these things. But if you want to reach out, if you want more information, I'm sure I can provide it. Those two groups are excellent at providing it as well. But in no means by any of my language or any of the things that I convey here do I want to make anyone feel bad about what they're involved in currently. We all have our different limits and where we're at in our journey, and I supremely respect that. That being said, what I'm communicating here is not an ultimate truth for anyone, right? This is the truth that I know based on my experience. Everyone should consider the things that they've learned and what they know, and then determine the best course of action for themselves and what is and what is not the truth. So everyone should always be thinking for themselves. And through that process, that's when I think we can really affect positive change for ourselves. What that is not is blindly trusting people and their word, including medical practitioners and doctors. You should always do your own research and use your own experiential information or data and whatnot to make your own decisions. That being said, this is the best of what I know right now. With all the things that I've been through, all the people that have helped me learn, and all the things that I've seen in my life, this is a composite of that information, and this is the very best that I have at this point. That may be significant for some people. It may mean nothing to others. Either way, it's perfectly fine. I hope that the information I give is enlightening for everybody and helpful in some way. But I understand that some of it may not be helpful to some people. I have helped people find a diet, for instance, that was really strict, but for me had been really beneficial. And for that person, it was harmful. So in that essence, none of us are exactly the same, right? Same thing with medical treatments. If you one medical treatment may work for somebody and may harm someone else, right? That's a dimension of life for everyone at all times, right? So what's working for me here may not work for you. It may be dangerous and harmful to you, even though it seems subtle or small. These are all things we have to consider and go forward in the safest and most intelligent and wise way that we can discern. So with that little heads up, I'll get started. I'll start with some of the most basic stuff that I see as like a foundation or a fundamental thing you got to nail to really start healing. So, and I'll move on to kind of more complex or philosophical ideas later and some more complicated things or more interesting things that have happened to me in my life that affected my healing. I've healed from a lot of things in my life, including psychiatric drugs previous times. And then also primarily what this focuses on is the extreme neurological injury I received from transcranial magnetic stimulation. That being said, there's one principle that's really important for people that have gone through something traumatic, difficult, or something that really impacted their health. And that's that if you've gone through something really impactful, you're always going to be healing for the rest of your life. And we all hope that there's this day when we don't have to heal anymore. We're fully healed. We feel good. And we're just in full health. I think I had psychiatric injury from medication earlier on in my life. And when I look back at that, I realized that I never fully healed from that. I felt better. I did things that I thought would have enabled me to fully heal. But the injury actually probably would have taken me years to heal from. But I considered myself healed in like 6 to 9 months. And looking back, there were things that stuck with me that shouldn't have, and I should have been more mindful of that I wasn't. So that being said, a big pitfall for healing up front is people thinking, you know, you made it through this big hurdle and the majority of your stuff is gone, so you're all healed up, or the majority of you is healed up, so the rest is just going to be easy. But I've seen that as a big pitfall for a lot of people. It's not. Like, you're going to continue to heal. You may feel really healed and really good one day, only to have a setback or something really unpleasant happen to you later on another day, and you realize that you weren't as healed, and maybe you did things that weren't that healthy in the meantime. So having patience and fortitude with healing is a major factor. I'll say that really straight up front. That being said, exercise and activity seems to be an absolute fundamental of healing. So when I say exercise in relation to a neurological injury, I read a book on a fellow that recovered. He was diagnosed in his late 50s with mild cognitive impairment, which if you don't have any other health conditions, that's essentially early onset dementia, right? So this book, I think it was called, I got it on Amazon when I was searching for cognitive impairment recovery. And it was called Beating the Dementia Monster, I think. If you search that up, the book should come up. I mean, it's just a guy. I think he's an engineering degree. He's a really bright guy, but he's not like a notable author or any big time person that you might read about, which is interesting because I find that people that write stories with no motivation that just comes from their own genuine experience, I find that a lot more honest and informative than if I went and, say, picked up some bestseller from Barnes & Noble. I can't tell you how incredibly disappointed I've been in trying to read about diet and exercise and healing in bestseller books. I loathe them, honestly, and I pretty much refuse to read them because they're always trying to please audiences and make sales. And in that, you lose, I think, the valuable content trying to make certain people happy. But anyways, that's the case. That was the case here. And in that book, he highlighted a lot of foods that were good for brain health, blueberries, you know, green vegetables and stuff, and how your diet needs to be rich in that. But I'll get to eating in a minute. But the point was, what he thought was absolutely essential was exercise. So he said 45 minutes of cardio every single day. And I believe that he included the weekend on that. So even on the weekend, you should do some sort of cardio exercise, 45 minutes, where you begin sweating at a pace or a cadence that you start sweating in the first 5 minutes. So it has to be fairly intense cardio. There's a lot of people out there that they can't do that. They can't tolerate it based on their injury. And that's perfectly fine. But I do at least 45 minutes of cardio a day. But I exclude weekends. Lots of times I don't go on the weekend. Sometimes I do. It just depends on where I'm at. Sometimes I'm just really intense on exercise, trying to feel better, maybe because I had a setback. Or I'm just really feeling good, so I want to continue to exercise. So I do shoot for that 45 minutes of cardio every day where I'm sweating the vast majority of the time. There's been times where I didn't do it for 3 months, but I went out and got other activity. There was a time where I felt that being out in nature and being outside was vastly more beneficial for me than exercising. And I just didn't have the time and the energy and the ability to do both, to exercise and be out in nature every day. So again, trust yourself. Trust what your gut's telling you. If you think you need to hit cardio, then do it. If you think you just need to be really active, or there's certain goals that you see for yourself of activity, like, hey, I don't get out of bed, so I just want to get up today and walk around my house. That might be a really big deal. But your gut's going to tell you what you need to do. So go for it. Try it. You may not even be able to achieve your goals, but start working towards it. Build a mindset to where you're actively looking forward to and working towards activity. And a really big piece of that is looking forward to activity. So there's a lot of books and a lot of stuff out there. For instance, I used to run just long distances, right? So I was reading books about ultra marathon running. And there's a lot of the guys doing that. They would just get up and run. Like, you could tell that they looked forward to running, so that's what they did. There was another article I read by a guy that was, I think he was running this series of Spartan races, but not Spartan like the American like business where they do all these crazy obstacles and stuff on this long kind of marathon type obstacle course. But he was running 300 milers in a row. So, and this was in Greece, I think. So it was called like a Spartan 300. And so he was a really prolific runner. But the important thing was what he said was that we are not meant to just run the same circuits over and over again and do the same exercises over and over again. What he attributed to being able to run so well was that he changed his run based on what he felt. So he would be running, you know, for instance, here, if I was to run, right, there's not a lot of options. So I could run down the street, I could run to the park, run around the park, or if I ran long enough, I could get out into nature around here. But if you do that every single day, it gets old, right? So he would, in his mind, he'd come up with these challenges for himself that would challenge him to run further in these different locations. And to him, the entire meaning of running and doing this extreme or activity or pushing yourself to your limits, a lot of that is based on setting new goals and constantly changing what you think is your limits and pursuing those things. But what I took away from it was that your mindset has to be on having fun and enjoying and growing based on the exercise that you're doing. And I think at this point, with the activity that I do and the exercise that I've done, which has been a lot in my lifetime, I used to run like 10 miles a day and 20 miles a day on the weekend. So, and it always came down to me wanting to get up and run and do those things. For instance, if I kept pushing myself to run when I didn't want to run, I actually would usually throw an injury. I broke my knee doing that. Yeah, that was a really big lesson for me. So I think I've seen that in other people a lot. So I think it's a pretty fair universal. The reason why exercise is so important is because it works your circulatory system. So if you have medications that are built up and stored in your cells, you want to purge those from your body. You want to detox. You want to get your systems working in a healthy way. So in my eyes, that's why exercise and activity is essential. Exercise is a pretty diverse one in terms of what people can do. So don't be upset with yourself for not doing something rigorous. Everyone should be there to beat themselves or to exceed your own expectations of what you think that you can do and grow your own expectations for physical activity. Could be small, it could be great, but which one it is not important. The only person you're trying to beat is yourself. The only person you're trying to improve on is yourself. You don't need to think for a moment about what other people are doing unless it's in reference to trying to learn, you know, something new or something that might be effective for you. All right, so the next one is eating. I've tried to tackle eating healthy even since I was a small child. My dad used to go through times where he'd eat really healthy and clean up his diet and then get into really immaculate physical shape based on his eating. And he shared a lot of that with me. And for me, what I learned from him was a lot of hodgepodge stuff. Like I learned some things like clean your system out, you know. I learned that fasting, you know, can help your body reset and clean out your systems. And that's important. But it's also, you know, a dangerous thing. Fasting is a very serious pursuit and you have to be mentally right to fast. If you casually fast, and I'm talking like for days here, there's a lot of risks involved in that. And fasting without having the right mindset is dangerous. But fasting with the right mindset can be absolutely miraculous. I know there's accounts of miraculous healing based on fasting, and that's the principle, that's what people want. But even if there's not miraculous healing, there's tremendous, like your mind changes when you're fasting, your whole mental perspective will change, you'll learn a tremendous amount about yourself, and then your body will make tremendous changes as well, and usually for the positive as long as your mind's in the right spot. But that's along the lines of eating. So I've tried a lot of different diets. I've changed the way I eat at lots of times for a really positive. The more aggressive I've been with eating, I tend to feel better, and it's usually geared around just eating cleaner, healthier foods that I'm learning about. I could probably have a whole podcast on these specific topics, but I'm going to focus in on what has worked the best for me since my injury. And for me, something I learned about after I was harmed that I went after is called the Candida diet. For me specifically, it was the Candida Cure by Ann Broach. And she had multiple sclerosis and she healed herself from that and wrote a book about it based on just strictly her diet. And she had eaten really poorly like her whole life, and it led to some really bad effects on her body. But what I took away from that and what I've learned the most after TMS is, especially in America, there's a tremendous amount of crap in our food. Like there's just tons of it. There's sugar in everything. If you look, they put sugar in everything. Now, for me, I'm always going to come back to this question of, evolutionarily, are we meant to be exposed to this? And when you ask yourself that, evolutionarily, are we exposed to sugar? The answer is no. Like only extremely remote localities have had access to sugar, and it's in small quantity, right? It wasn't in all the food that they ate. It was an intent, like if they had sugar cane or whatever, like they would eat that at that time. It wouldn't be in all the rest of their food, and they would see the consequence or the benefit of it. So look at what you're eating. Pay close attention. Read the labels. You'll see there's a ton of crap in food. There's a ton of synthesized things. There's a ton of fake stuff. There's a ton of chemicals. There's a ton of sugar. There's a ton of gluten. There's a ton of dairy. dairy might be a controversial one, right? But I've never reacted to dairy. When I was a kid, I would have ear infections, and my dad took me to the doctor. Of course, they wanted to do a procedure and put tubes in my ears. My dad was like, no freaking way, right? So he did some research, went to the library. I remember him telling me that. It's like, I had a problem. I went to the library to figure it out. So he went to the library, and he found out that dairy could have an impact on kids' mucus production and their ears. So he took dairy out of my diet. I was healed. I had no more ear problems after that. You know, of course, the doctor was baffled and all this, but my dad woke up to a lot of stuff based on that experience and others on learning the truth about our health and what impacts our health. And this is another funny side note is, you ever realize they feed you trash in hospitals? Like, you get the worst food in hospitals. It's like super processed and just not healthy, not organic. It's like they're trying to keep you sick in there. And I noticed that lately, especially now that I've been paying attention to how impactful food is. And it's just been another piece of evidence that the medical system is negligent and reckless, and it's not appropriate. If you are treating people in a hospital and they're in your recovery wing, you should be feeding them the best food available to help them recover. It makes absolutely no sense that you would feed them stuff that you either had direct evidence had a negative impact on them, or were even suspicious there could be a negative impact, or just wasn't fresh and healthy. Like, who does that? Who is trying to help someone recover from an illness or a procedure and gives them stuff that's not fresh or considered healthy? It's just totally baffling. But anyways, that's really at the core of my thoughts around food, is that we really look and examine and look for the truth around food. And again, I always go back to historically, what did we eat? What are our bodies evolved to eat? Right? Like vegetables, fresh, untainted meat. I know there's vegans and vegetarians out there that don't eat meat, and I think that's legit. I'd like to do that one day. I don't. I have small portions of like organic, range-free, grass-fed meat in my diet right now. But some of the most prolific ultra runners and athletes in the world are totally vegan. So that just tells you right there that if someone's trying to tell you that you have to eat meat for your health, that's absolutely not true. That's a lie, right? Plenty of people are vegan and vegetarian and are extremely healthy, and I would argue even more healthy than me right now, or healthier than most of us. So these are the things we should think about the truth and observe what's out there to really learn about it, because there's a tremendous amount of misinformation. In fact, around food, I'd argue that most of the information out there is misinformation. It's false, and it's highly charged in order to feed an agenda or sell a book or some other rubbish. So pay close attention. But I'll get to it. So I follow the Anne Broach protocol of the Candida diet, essentially. So her book's out there. You can get it. It's worked really well for me. It hasn't. There's other people that have reported to me that it didn't work for them, or it even made them worse or sick. So you need to be careful. You need to consider the changes very carefully, but I fully recommend it. When I was healing from TMS, I was in a really severe, horrible place. And then 3 months after I changed my diet, all of a sudden I had windows of feeling a little bit better. And where 2 years previous to that, every minute of every day was hell for me. So there, I don't believe in coincidence like that. I know that purging and detoxing the bad stuff that had built up in my body and then feeding it the stuff that it was evolutionarily meant to have, I know that played a tremendous impact on my health. And I attribute that to a reason that I was able to recover at all from my injury. After I had purged all the crap out of my diet and I only ate organic, free-range food, mostly chicken, fish, and I had a little bit of red meat, and then the rest of it was just vegetables and some grains, but not grains like wheat and stuff. I had zero gluten, zero dairy, zero sugar, nothing artificial in my diet, is all no sugar. So some grains like cassava flour, almond flour, and stuff like that. But when I did that, it was agonizing. Like, the change was so difficult. For at least 30 days, I was just in complete agony because my body was so addicted and so hooked on sugar and this other crap. And I completely identified it as withdrawal. I even identified that I had extremely addictive behaviors around sugar. I had this real relapse moment where my family had bought cookies. they knew that I was on this diet and they're trying to hold me accountable, and I was trying to hold myself accountable. Well, I took those cookies and I hid under the table and I stuffed my face with like half a box. And I looked at myself and I was like, this is insane. Like, and I was thinking about how I was going to lie to my family about how I didn't eat those cookies. I had a moment where I realized that I was totally addicted to sugar and my behavior was totally insane. It was totally unacceptable. Like, if I was doing that with drugs or something else, then that would be like criminal, or it would just like devastate my family, right? But it's cookies, so everyone has a laugh. But to me, it wasn't funny because I broke the healthy habit that I was trying to build because I gave into temptation. It wasn't because I made a choice to do it. I was completely compelled to just get sugar in my body. This is one thing I learned about myself, and I actually learned a lot about others through that process, I think, as well. But once I got through that 30 days of detox, approximately, not only did I have windows into feeling better from my TMS injury, I also completely changed the way I looked at food, and it became spiritual for me. Like, everything I did every day was built around what I was going to eat. And my body started reacting really positively to my food intake. Like, my whole body would feel like good, like kind of like vibrant and healthy. Like, and I would actually get really hungry even after I had eaten. And at first I thought it was some sort of problem that I was having, but I realized after a little bit of time and contemplation that my body wanted those good nutrients so bad, it just didn't stop being hungry for them. Like, I constantly wanted to consume it. And even after I was full on it, like, I wouldn't feel full. My body would metabolize it so quickly that it was just kind of unheard of for me. It was just this new concept. But what I realized is that once you attune your mind and your body to the right food coming in and out, that your whole reality changes. The way I looked at everything changed. Like, I had this kind of epiphany of how impactful it was for us to get on a diet that is what we're supposed to eat. Like, back in the day, we were hunter-gatherers. We're running from wild animals, keeping our tribe safe. We were protecting ourselves from austere environments, from hot and cold, and gathering regularly, right? Like, so we had a tremendous amount of danger in our lives, right? So our bodies and our brains needed to be really, really sharp. And what I realized, and really, really attuned to our environment, and what I realized that when we eat right, there's a changeover that happens because we're just used to eating junk. But when we eat right, we can get to homeostasis and we can get to this kind of evolved place for our mind and our body, and we can achieve much higher function. Even in the state of injury, I achieved, you know, this state of function and this state of well-being. Even though I can feel my cognitive impairment and these other issues, there are other parts of me that was just functioning way better than I ever thought I could. And that's when some of my injuries started to resolve. Even though I still face like huge problems with it, my emotions were actually what started to first improve. When I had those windows, I actually felt happy for like 5 minutes. And after 2 years of feeling horrible for every minute of every day, that was like, it was like getting slapped in the face and a bucket of ice cold water thrown on your head at the same time. Like, that's how impactful it was. I was like, I didn't understand what happiness felt like anymore. And then when it happened, it totally blew my mind. And I realized that a part of that was my food intake and the really incredible changes it made to my internal physiology and my neurology. So I wanted to share that. It was a really, really big deal in my recovery. And furthermore, there's stuff in our food that we don't even understand in terms of bad stuff. So there was this moment when things really came together to me, or I had this validation for my ideas about food and eating kind of primitively in a way, is that I was watching Michael Baum on a Medicating Normal panel. He's been involved in a lot of psychiatric medication litigation, but he was also involved in the Roundup litigation. And what he said on there, inevitably this was a conversation about psychiatric injury, right? And people had come to ask him, like, hey, you know, what do you do to stay healthy? How can people recover from psychiatric injury? Which is interesting because he's a lawyer. I don't know that he has a lot of commentary on that or that he should. But if he does, I mean, that's all the better, right? So he was saying, I mean, essentially the same thing. And one reason I believe so firmly in what I'm saying is because I've heard it from tons of sources, from really intelligent people that aren't interested in being popular, but are interested in other people's well-being. And Michael Baum was one of them. And so he's saying, and if you don't know what's involved in litigating a large company like Monsanto, you really should look it up. But if you're a lawyer and you're litigating this company, you literally spend like 5 to 7 years learning every single last thing you can about this company and the effects of the drugs or the devices they're using and how that impacts the human body. It's tremendous. So the learning and the wisdom that people garner from this stuff is absolutely invaluable. In fact, I'm a big proponent of what we learn from litigation. Like the most profound things that I've learned and the most truth that I've found have been from depositions and documents that have been uncovered during discovery from litigating some of these large companies and these different things. And then expert witness testimony as well, because it's rare that you get experts to really buckle down and write down the important things about how humans can be negatively affected by stuff, but they're forced to do it in litigation, right? They have to pay an expert a lot of money to write down, hey, this is what hurts people and this is why. The rest of the medical community doesn't want to comment on that because they don't want to get black booked or looked down upon or lose their credibility in the medical community from denouncing what someone else is doing. So Michael Baum has a tremendous amount of exposure to that. He's done tremendous good work in litigating pharmaceutical companies, and it just seems like a really outstanding guy. But something that kind of locked that in for me was he's talking about how to heal from psychiatric injury, and he brings up what he learned from Roundup litigation. He's saying that the pesticides that we spray on our food ends up all the way in the microbiota in our stomach, and it has a tremendous impact on everything in our body through our stomach. And essentially what he said was like, you can't do that. If you want to maintain your health, like you're going to have a profound impact to everything. If you're ingesting poisons on your food, even if you're not aware of it, it gets to every part of your body, you know, through your stomach. I mean, he was so much more succinct and clear and learned than I am, but he was communicating that information that there's a lot going on out there that we don't know about and that we don't understand from eating poor food. And it has a tremendous impact on us, and just not to underestimate that. And that just the pesticides on our food play a huge role in that. And it ends up playing a really significant role in our gut health. And that's not even right. That's not even gluten. That's not all these other things that have a negative impact. This is just pesticides on non-organic food, right? And maybe even on some organic food, right? We always have to be skeptical. We always have to be thinking. We always have to be measuring how we react to food, especially for the injury community, to try to do what's best for us and try to enable an environment of true healing. So with that being said, I think I hit the gist of what it was, and I gave you a resource. But again, I could have a whole podcast on eating. But you should study dietary stuff really, really, really closely and learn as much as you can about it, because this is one of the only ways that we can have a holistic effect on our body. You have to eat, right? Like you have to eat 3 times a day. So if we look at food as medicine, you're taking medicine 3 times a day to heal your body, right? So if we're eating healthy food that's nutrients, that's going to help your body heal and achieve homeostasis, like you're doing that 3 times a day. If it's junk, you're inhibiting your body 3 times a day. If you're looking at what's going to heal your body and get it back on the right track, then you have 3 opportunities a day to do that. And that's really profound. And maybe the biggest and most important impact and lessons, the most significant impact I've had on my health has come from eating. I think that speaks for itself. All right, so next I'm going to talk about environment. So I had a good friend of mine who's a neuroscientist. So he runs study groups and does like this really like multi-million dollar projects for neurology, right? Like for neurological medicine, he's a scientist. with all these accolades and all this stuff. And I was lucky enough to talk to him, and we had this big long conversation. He was telling me how psychiatric drugs, like, he's done a ton of research on them. And by research, I mean he's actually done the research himself and ran the studies himself and looked at it. And what he said was that you have about 3 months of taking psychiatric drugs before, like, he can see the evidence that he's seen himself shows that they turn into toxins in your body, and like neurotoxins, and just start wreaking havoc on your brain. I think Dr. Peter Bragan said you take one pill of psychiatric drugs and it's enough to change your brain chemistry forever. These are just really serious considerations that I wanted to share in this moment. But back to the point, is that he's telling me this stuff, and I'm trying to figure out how I can recover from my TMS injury. And he says, out of all the studies, everything that I've found, you know, in the last however many years, and all of this research, is that for the brain, you need to get into a stress-free environment. If you want to heal, you need to focus on being happy, and you need to get rid of everything else in your life. And he told me, he said, oh, I know you're in a really bad spot, right? He said, for someone like you that is in as desperate a situation as you are, he said, you need to quit everything that doesn't make you happy or anything that brings you stress. He says, I'm dead serious. Like, if someone says, hey, do you want to do this? And you think it's stressful, he's just say no. If you have friends and family that are around you that are stressful, he said, just say no. Get them out of your life. He said, they'll kill you. Like, if you're really in a bad spot and you're trying to heal from a neurological injury, you need them gone. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. You either die or you get them out of your life, essentially. And that means something different for everyone. I don't want people to interpret that as like, just go out and like do something reckless, right? Like, I spent a lot of time contemplating what was stressful in my life and what wasn't, but I did exactly what he said. I got rid of every last piece of stress that I could in my life. And I think it's been and I know it's been a huge help. Put it this way, like, if eating allowed me to heal, getting rid of stress in my life enabled eating to let me heal. In other words, if I had a lot of stress in my life, I could eat the best diet that I wanted to, and it could be exactly what my body needed, but all of the cortisol, all the stress hormones running through my body would have killed me or made my injury worse anyways, because the environment wasn't right for that healing to occur. That's something I know just unequivocally, right? It's just totally foundational for neurological healing. I've read it in studies. I hadn't heard kind of some of the stuff before he told me that. But when he told me that kind of in this off the record setting, I knew that he was incredibly serious and it was the real deal. So I wanted to communicate that to everybody out there, that if you have toxic relationships, if you have stuff that's bringing you stress in your life, you really got to consider, some of us even as jobs, right? We're working after our injury and we're disabled, but we're trying to just get on and just maintain this appearance of being happy and healthy or being a good worker or something like that. And if it's a toxic work environment, if your work isn't helping you heal, you may need to consider letting go of your work. I'm just being honest. I know that's a massive ask for people, right? And some people are just like, I can't do that. And I've talked to people that had no family and no friends, and they only had their job, and they're like, I can't stop working. That would just end my life. And they were being completely serious with me. And I understood that. And I said, if you can't do that, you can't do that. I get it. But I'm telling you what worked for me and what I think everybody has to consider, and that's your environment. You have to have a positive environment that enables healing, not only for neurological, like physiological, neurological factors, like the physical healing of your brain, but also for all the emotional dynamics that you handle. You know, you have to believe that your life is good. You have to believe that you have happiness in your life to heal. Like, there's just this direction and this narrative that's going to enable you to feel better. If you're constantly thinking about how bad you have it and all the toxic relationships you have and how you have nothing to look forward to, in my experience, I mean, that slowly kills you. And I'm saying that's because I've really experienced that in my life. I've been in parts of my life where I had everything, like a great job, money, great family, all this stuff, but I didn't look at it that way. I looked at it like, I have all these obligations, I hate my job, I don't have enough money, and my family's great, but they have all these demands and all these expectations of me. Looking back, I'm horrified because I should have been so happy. And yet, that's when I ended up in the hands of psychiatry with extreme anxiety, extreme depression, and not wanting to live any longer, right? So it's all a matter of perspective. And the only thing that matters is what's going through your mind at the time and how you're looking at these things. One thing that was, as a side note, one of the things that was helpful for me was cognitive behavioral therapy. It helped me reframe my thinking when I had those kinds of thoughts. When I had good things in my life that I looked at as negative, it helped me question myself and add an honest context for the things I was experiencing instead of just like this doom and gloom thinking that I had developed from a time when my life was actually bad. So something to consider. So kind of in that respect of community also, or environment comes community. So there's toxic relationships, right, that we have to try to minimize and contemplate their value in our healing process. And then there's also kind of this positive respect to that. And it's tribe, or that's what I call it, because Sebastian Unger has this book called Tribe that I knew later on in my career and in my life. I realized how important it was to have good people around you that can help, and having diverse thoughts around you that can enable you to make good decisions and consider alternatives to what you're thinking that may give you a lot healthier options. This is a really big consideration when it comes to our environment, and it's like a force multiplier. So it's a way for you to take kind of your ability to heal to the next level. And if you get rid of your toxic relationships and you start incorporating positive relationships and positive tribe members into your life who are oriented the same way that you are, who are open-minded and focused on improving things and looking at things in truth and honesty, then you indefinitely like expand your potential for healing. The survivor community is so incredible. I don't even have words for it. Like, I had these limitations around the people that I knew and the resources I had available to me, like in my physical environment, my physical like relationships, right? But once I got into the survivor community, I started meeting people and talking to them and sharing with them. And I mean, ultimately, I was trying to network. I hate that word. It's really cliche and it has this horrible connotation behind it of like trying to gain things for yourself. But when I was in the survivor community, I was just trying to meet people and to learn from people. And when I did that, I expected these people to be crappy, to be honest with you, and to not be helpful or to be selfish. What I found was the complete opposite. I found the most compassionate, intelligent, caring, and open people that I had ever met in my whole life. Just person after person. These people have been through horrific traumas, and then they would just turn around and ask me what happened to me and what they could do to help me and all the things that they had done to try to find healing and the things that had worked and the things that hadn't worked. And it was all incredibly genuine and honest. And I know this because I've had plenty of experiences in my own life that I kind of measure up to others to gauge the truth, to see, you know, is this really what's going on? And I know a lot of people say a lot of fake stuff to you that you identify in your life is like, hey, that's kind of fake, right? And people say this all the time. And I know someone's not being genuine with me when they say this. And I really didn't run into any of that. I kept getting brutal honesty after brutal honesty from these people. And there's a good reason for that. But what that did was it enabled me to heal. It enabled me to find the candida cure, for instance, right? Enabled me to find better ways to heal myself mentally, my neurology, for instance, neuroplasticity. Like, I didn't know about it, right? Like, friends in the community gave me these books. Angela Peacock recommended that I get The Brain That Changes Itself, which was a huge eye-opener for me in terms of learning about neuroplasticity. Another one I haven't read yet about tinnitus, I think, and dizziness is called Rock Steady, that she recommended as well. That is just the beginning. Like, I have a whole shelf of books that have helped me learn. Anatomy of an Epidemic was a recommendation from a friend of mine that had been hurt by TMS as well. Peter Gosch's book, Dangerous Medicines and Organized Crime. I then had Jim Gottstein's book, The Zyprexa Papers, that just blew my mind in terms of understanding the reality of what happens to you if you're involuntarily committed or you come under state's care and you have a guardianship, and the side effects of drugs, the legal system. Like, Jim goes into kind of what happens with litigation and all of the different things that happen there, how they hide documents, how those documents can be released, and how much of it is like the Wild Wild West. It's just really, it's crazy. If you can read any of those books, especially the Zyprexa papers, they're just really eye-opening on the realities of what's going on out there that people don't talk about. And that's the most unfortunate thing, is they don't talk about it. But the point is, and there's a bunch of other stuff, I can possibly get to it all, but I'll try over the series, over all these episodes in my cast. But the point is that once I started opening myself up to other people in the community, and I experienced this tribe where when I had problems, or I had a problem that I didn't know how to solve and I reached out to people, they started feeding me answers, and they started giving me other people to talk to who had experienced what I was looking at, and all the pieces of the puzzle came together. And yeah, sure, it's great. I got answers and I figured things out and I learned stuff, but that was a small piece of the reward. The reward was feeling loved and cared for. All these people, they would do the same thing. They'd reciprocate and they'd come back to me and ask me questions, and they would send people to me that were considering TMS treatment, that wanted a really true and honest informed consent on what could happen to you during the treatment. And I mean, in effect, we were saving each other's lives. And that kind of love and camaraderie and care has immense value to the human heart, soul, and mind. These things, you can't mimic them. You can't get them anywhere else. I honestly believe that we were wired for tribe. We're wired to operate in small groups and care for each other and supplement each other's needs and abilities. And it wasn't until I experienced this that I really, really understood how important it is. I mean, tribes don't really exist anywhere anymore. There's some like the Bushmen and the Kalahari. There's like these small groups of tribes some places, but no one's talking about it. If you search really hard, you can find it. There are books on it. I've read about it in a few places, and I've always been completely amazed. If you want to see miracles, if you want to see beautiful stuff that's happening, I mean, look at what indigenous tribes are doing, and you'll see tremendous amount of love and caring, and things you just couldn't even imagine are happening there. And just because they're not talking about it doesn't make it any less significant. It's just incredible. But for us to go back and get that in our lives, when we were wired for that, we were meant for that, it has a tremendous impact on healing. And you can't buy that. You can't get it somewhere else. You can't get it from a doctor who sees you for 15 minutes and then rushes you out because he has to get to his next patient, right? You can't get that from a family that's been indoctrinated to think you just watch TV all night, you don't talk, they send you off to college, and then you go and live on your own and you only see them around the holidays, right? This isn't, we weren't raised up in American culture, at least, and a lot of other industrial cultures, to like love and care for each other and to take on other people's problems as our own. And that's really tragic, but human beings are inherently meant for that. And in that environment, it enables healing, it enables homeostasis, it enables us to feel free. And it's got tremendous healing value and tremendous healing potential. Whereas the opposite is also true, and a lack of caring, trauma, harm that we inflict on one another creates death. I mean, I've been in situations where that's happened to me, and I just wanted to curl up and die for months after that, and I just couldn't get out of my head how someone didn't care for me or didn't love me in such an intense way. It made me not want to exist anymore, and I thought I was a weirdo for that or a freak, but what it turns out is that that's how we're wired, right? We're supposed to be accepted and loved by the people around us. And if we're not, there's something's wrong, and we're driven away from that because it's not natural and it's not how we survive, and it's just not good, not natural. And it's not historical. It's not what we're meant for. And it all makes sense. I pondered it for a really long time. I think you should think about it deeply too. It answered a lot of questions for me, and brought a tremendous amount of healing into my life. So those are the fundamentals of what I've found for healing. So now I'm going to explore some of the things that I found really important for healing. Some things essential, some things not, but I think it's more open to interpretation. I'll jump around here to random stuff. I'll tell you the one thing that made a big difference for me, and I think set all the healing into motion, was freedom. I realized that I spent my whole life living up to other people's expectations, thinking that I had to work for money, and I didn't have a choice in anything. And I looked at life as just this giant, long piece of slavery. At my job one time, I was taking phone calls when I first started there. And we had this headset on, and the company I was working for measured all of our metrics. So they knew how long we were on the phone. They knew how many calls we answered. They know how quickly we handled our calls, all this stuff. And we were, our job performance was all based on that. And this one lady that I had started with, she were talking to me one day, and she's just like, "You know what that headset is?" And I was like, "No, what are you talking about?" She goes, "It's a shackle. Like, this is just slavery. The headset is nothing more than a shackle." And one, she was completely right. And two, I think her disdain for the situation and subsequently my own helped to shine light in kind of an inverse way on what I came to learn now. And that is, freedom is absolutely key to healing. Freedom is absolutely key to life. And I'm probably going to do a cast, or I'd like to, on just strictly this subject matter. But if you don't feel free, it's really hard to heal. If you feel forced into anything, it's really hard to heal. It adds stress. It adds a lot of negative stuff. And whether you decide to do something or not should always be your free choice and free decision. If you're working and you feel like you have to, it should still be by your choice. And if your choice is to quit, or your choice is to change the way you're doing something, I would encourage you to do that. And I will argue to the ends of the earth that what you learn from pursuing freedom is much more valuable and much more healing than what you won't learn from just doing something because you think you have to. And that process of changing things up and acting in your freedom and not doing things that you think you should do, but just not doing it because you don't feel free, you feel trapped by it. That whole process is a natural process, and that's a process in which we learn and evolve into better people, into like kind of truer embodiments of ourselves. So if you deprive yourself of that process, of that learning process, you just become a slave, right? Everything you do, you think you do because you have to, and then you never learn. But what I've found is the more I stop and figure things out before I make a decision, yeah, that might impact things. You know, people don't want you to go slow. They want you to hurry up and do things. They want you to do what they think, and they want you to do what people expect you to do, right? It impacts things, yeah. So people will be disappointed with you for certain reasons, right? But the more you understand what you're doing, the more control you have over it, right? Having a complete functional understanding of what you're doing has a tremendous reward. And it's the way you're supposed to operate, in my mind, so that you, one, you understand what you're doing, and two, you can make healthy decisions on it as well, right? If you always feel compelled to do something, you don't know when you've crossed an ethical boundary because you already were not in it, right? You weren't in it for the right reasons. So when someone says, now steal this, or now fudge this paperwork, or now change these numbers, you didn't want to do it in the first place. So what do you care if you steal from somebody else, or you change data in a medical study that ends up harming millions of people, right? You didn't want to do it in the first place. So there's no skin off your back, right? I know this. I worked in banking for 15 years. That was the status quo over there. But to come back around, freedom in its true form is a healing process. It's a learning process. It's a healthy process. A lot of us give up on that, and it enables an environment that just turns toxic and is not conducive to healing. And a lot of us, I think, have to rethink that and rework through it. And I say that from experience. That's what I had to do. When I got hurt from TMS, I had to think about what led me to that bad decision. And what led me to that bad decision was doing what I thought I was obligated to do. And that at the time was continue to work. I was like, I have to continue to work. I'm depressed. Like, I need to hook a powerful electromagnetic magnet up to my head and zap my brain until I feel better so I can work for longer. It's just a really poor thinking process. I hope that's never been you, but if it has, or you've had something similar, I'd urge you to reconsider it and think about it deeply and make a choice for freedom, no matter what the cost is. I think there's no cost to freedom. I'd rather be penniless and on the street and free than be a rich slave. And that's because I've lived it. So in my mind, in terms of some of the more abstract ways to heal, that's it, like at the top of the list. Like you got to be free. You got to have a free mindset in order to go forward. Some people might disagree. I'm sure lots of people do. But for me, that was a big one. So after that, another really big one for healing is neuroplasticity. So our brain builds maps of thinking patterns of activity, like the way our bodies work. Like, right, if you pick up a spoon in the same way 1,000 times in your life, your brain builds a map for picking up a spoon, right? And you always pick it up the same way. You always handle it the same way. If you try to do it differently, it feels awkward. And that's because your brain's trying to write a new map in order to handle the spoon if you do it differently. So that kind of tells you how neuroplasticity works, right? We have these maps that we're used to using that make things easy. And then when we go against that, things are difficult. That's because our brain's working trillions of different variables every second. We're moving. There's sound and smell and light and all these texture feelings in your hand and all these nerves and muscles, fibers that it's moving to get you to do stuff, right? So you may be picking up a spoon differently, but your mind is actually manipulating the billions of connections in a different way so that you can pick up a spoon in a different way. So now you see the task that is at hand for your mind and building a new map for you doing something differently. So with that, right, we have bad habits and we have healthy habits and everything in between. So when we're healing, like for me, I was used to going to a job, that job sucking, coming home, eating and going to bed and getting up and doing the same thing all over again. So when that was over, I had to change everything, right? Like I needed to build new habits around what I did, how I spent my time, not going to work, doing something different. And this was really problematic because my brain did not want to do these things. So what I found, if you don't replace a habit with something else, usually it's just painful and arduous, right? So if I just didn't go to work and I just sat and stared at the wall, right? Like I'd just be miserable. I'm not replacing that map, that neural map that I had with something, you know, beneficial or something that increased plasticity, which is flexibility, mental flexibility, right? So what I found and what I learned is that the more diverse our thoughts are, the more diverse our experiences are, the more plastic our brain becomes and the more receptive it is to change, right? So I hadn't done art in years. I hadn't built Legos in years. But once I learned about plasticity, I started doing these things just to get my brain to break up the maps that it had in there. I started smelling things that I hadn't smelt before. I started stopping and smelling good food. I smelt flowers. I would sit and look at a mountain and see how beautiful it was and take in the smell and feel the wind across my face and look at the leaves blowing in the wind. I would try to draw a picture of that in my mind later in the day. I would listen to music. Music was a really big one for me. After my injury, I realized that music would echo in my head for a really long time. I think it might even be kind of an OCD manifestation, and I've heard it from others as well. But if I had a bad song in my head, I would be utterly miserable because it would just play in my head over and over and over again. The more I thought about it, the more it would echo in there. But what I ended up realizing is that if I didn't listen to music I didn't like anymore, or let other people listen to it around me, which seems kind of horrible, but it was essential for my healing, I just listened to music that I loved. So I'd have songs and music in that I loved going through my head, and that would enhance the things that I was doing. It would keep my mood more positive. It would keep me looking forward to something. It would give me just a better feeling, right? It would feel like things were working for me and not against me. I know other people have talked about the same thing. So that it's another good dimension of healing, right? So I would start doing things with my left hand and the left side of my body to try to stimulate growth on the opposite side of my brain that was underused, right? There's all kinds of things that you can do differently that over time will just expand your mind's ability to be flexible. Because a lot of the problems that we have come from rigidity, and the same negative thinking patterns and the same negative maps built out in our mind that we just let our mind run into over and over again. So another thing you should think about and research if you have the time, neuroplasticity has been a big help to me, and I think just tons of others in terms of trying to recover. So kind of to piggyback on that, there's this idea of hope, right? When you're healing, people will say, you know, you need hope. And that's absolutely true. So what I've found is that creating this mental dynamic around hope is kind of weak, right? Like if I just kept thinking, oh, I hope that I get better. There's these things that I want to do in my life that would be great. That actually kind of turn on me. And I would think that I was never going to get to those things. And the hope that I had would actually work against me and turn into despair. But what I found is that when I built hope, it was a lot stronger than just believing it. So for instance, right, if I want to travel, right, I'm horrible at traveling, but I want to travel someday, right? So I do what I can. So like I'll get out and I'll go to the mountains that are closest to me, or the park, even a park that's a little bit further away, and I'll just get out and I'll walk around that park, or I'll go do whatever hike that I think I could handle, I'll go and do that, right? Because it's building my hope, right? If I want to visit a friend, right, I find a friend that's close by that I haven't seen for a while, and I'll think of something really fun to do with them that I probably never would have thought of otherwise, and I'll go and I'll do that thing in the hope that I'm building towards something greater. And I just keep doing that. Anything I can think of that would be fun, exciting, even if I'm not feeling that way or I don't feel like it would be exciting or fun, if I think that maybe I would feel that way in the future or that it was that way in the past, I'll do it. And what I found is that when I did that enough times, it started to come true. And I started looking forward to things and I built a tangible hope based on what I was actually doing to try to manifest hope for myself instead of just kind of sitting back in a chair and trying to think about what I'd like to do with my life, right? So that was kind of a neuroplastic exercise as well, like going out and experiencing things and learning from it and doing it over and over and over again until I got good at it and I built these new maps. And then before you know it, you're experiencing these moments where you can smell things better than you used to. The sound is more vivid, like the wind blowing across your face is more vivid. All of a sudden you're like alive in ways that you felt dead for years and years and years. Like it starts to transform. But sitting in my house has proven to be one of the most destructive things because my body and my brain's just not stimulated. My brain knows everything that's in my house. It knows all the textures of my house. It knows all the sights and sounds and the smells in my house, right? So when it's not getting exposed to unexpected and different things, I don't think that's particularly helpful. But what I do think is helpful is getting out there and doing different things that build your hope and your expectation for even something unknown in your future or just something positive. So with that was a biggie. And we're kind of getting into mental dynamics and mindsets here. So another big thing that's changed or has given me hope or has moved me in a positive direction is kind of this general mindset of exploring everything with a new mind and a new perspective and in complete honesty, right? So a lot of the things I thought I knew about in the past, I would re-examine those things. If they didn't make sense or I was just exposed to them a lot, I start looking at them from a different perspective, one of being injured, but also with an open mind saying, hey, my whole life I expected this stuff to be a certain way and I believed it was a certain way. Maybe it's not that way. And maybe this is a relationship. For me, it certainly was the way I looked at like doctors and medicine and procedures. A tremendous amount of it had to do with my personal relationships, and then even more of that had to do with how I understood my mind and my brain working, how my spirit or my soul connected to those things, how my body worked, and how I thought it worked, because a lot of these things ended up being false. Like I've been taught my whole life that my body was, you know, this system was these specific set of systems, and you could affect them with medications and exercise and eating well and all these things. But when I really leaned into that and looked at it honestly, I found that the vast majority of that stuff was false. And when I re-examined my life and the experiences that I had, I saw that I was actually ignoring a lot of the evidence that I had in favor of some sort of textbook knowledge or information I was given by a professional telling me that that wasn't true. And the funny thing is that science is a really marvelous thing, right? But you have to put it in its context, right? Science is good at examining things and learning about things that are observable. A lot of things in our life are not observable. There's a tremendous amount of stuff going on out there that we probably know a lot better than we can learn about scientifically. You just intuitively know things make sense to you, and they're just simplistic, right? But maybe we can't see them. You know, relational stuff, a lot of our thought dynamics, like they're not subject to science in the way that other things are. So you have to trust yourself. You have to work through it, and you have to learn from it and look at it in complete honesty. And while I'm speaking generally, what it boils down to for people that are in recovery or trying to heal from an injury is that you have to look at yourself and your injury in that light as well. You got to look at it in complete honesty. If a doctor says, hey, you know, you should react fine to a steroid injection, you know, in your neck if you have neck pain, but you have evidence that you're not reacting well to steroids, or that you may not from another resource, then you should think about that. There's a lot of adverse reactions that people have after neurological injury, and doctors don't really acknowledge this stuff, right? And it's very hard for science to observe it as well, because one, it'd be very difficult to get a study together with a bunch of neurologically injured people and then try to find some sort of baseline amongst those people and then find measurable, observable results, right? Like, you'd just be taking people's word for what they experienced. So science is not a good tool for that, right? But communities of people sharing their experience is a good tool for that, because you'll see commonalities. You'll see factors emerge that affect results for people, and you'll see consistencies across large groups in that way. That's how we know TMS injury is a real thing. It's not because I was affected by it and I'm sitting here telling you that that's the truth. It's because I was affected by it. I found thousands of other people that were affected by it in the same way, and it fits this paradigm of neurological injury that we see in other groups of people that have neurological harm. So in that way, the evidence is incontrovertible. It doesn't matter if you come out with a study that says that's not true. It just exists. Why? Because people sharing their stories consistently gives us all the evidence we need, right? It's the consistent story across thousands and thousands of people that tell us the truth. There's a million ways to disprove that, right? You could come up with studies and all these different things showing it's not true, but that doesn't make it any less true, right? Two people can observe an event and give completely different accounts of it, but the event still happened, right? The truth still exists out there. And that's precisely what I'm saying here, is that we have to look for the truth, and we have to be open to what's out there, and we have to be constantly learning about ourselves, learning about others. And with that perspective and what we learn about it leads us to healing. It leads us to trusting ourselves. It leads us to this tribe of other people that can trust us and we can trust them. And in this context, we have this hugely increased chance of healing. And we open ourselves up to a whole nother world of possibility by trusting each other and trusting ourselves and just being in this genuine learning environment where we just go forward and we don't go backwards. Okay. I think that gives us a really good foundational kind of basis for healing. And again, this is from my perspective. A lot of people have other perspectives. A lot of people have other knowledge out there. There's a lot of really great specifics on healing that other people have experienced that I'm going to try to interview people to get their perspectives on. I inherently don't try procedures. I don't do other things because I've seen negatives and I've seen positives, and I like to really try to keep a solid baseline of experience, meaning like the less that I do in treatments and supplements and all this stuff, like the more I can evaluate how well things work, right? So if I'm just eating healthy and exercising and I have this baseline, and then I try a supplement or I try a procedure or a therapy, right? I know if that works or if it doesn't. If some people, they do a lot of supplements at a time, they do a lot of treatments, right? They do a lot of procedures. And at the end of the day, I'm like, hey, you were doing this, you were doing that. Do you know which one worked? And they're like, no, I don't know, but this is when I got worse, or this is when I didn't feel well, you know? And ultimately it's almost impossible to know what it was without doing a bunch more follow-up work to figure it out. So that's where I'm at. I try to establish a healthy baseline and practice for kind of this healing paradigm that I'm in, and then try to expand from there. I hope that was helpful. I plan on having other guests on that want to talk about healing. If you want to talk about healing, if you have some more important stuff that fits into this puzzle, please reach out to me. I've covered a lot of good stuff so far, and now I'd like to have some guests on that can share their experience so that we can begin learning even more about all this subject matter that I've started to cover. But this gives you a really good idea of where I stand with it, kind of what my perspective is, and then kind of this basis for understanding things going forward. So thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you're having a good night. See you next time.